Do you want to?
You can be on your advisory boards, but I want you to think bigger. I want you to be on your transit boards. I want you to be a voting member of your transit board. Because then you get to have some say about where the money's spent. And in Georgia, we started that way in Savannah. We went to our transit board and we said, we want somebody with a disability to have voting power, because you're not listening to the advisory board when we come to you about what the needs of the disabled are. So that was the first step, and we were successful, but what we forgot to tell them was, and it needs to be somebody with a disability who actually rides the bus system on a regular basis. So we've kind of corrected that problem. So that's the first thing. And so not just on your transit board, if you have a transit system, but the other place you need to be, and they're desperate, trust me, on your MPOs and your regional commissions, and Metropolitan Organization, which is planning, Metropolitan Planning Organization, and Regional Commission is just that. Not only do they deal with transportation, but they deal with anything that's rural-related. Your aging, your water system in the rural areas, but transportation is a piece of that. So you want to be on those boards and at the table. And they're desperate, especially for citizen involvement, because they're required by the law to have citizens involved. So there again, when you're on those planning commissions, on your MPOs or your regional commissions, then you get to have a say. And the planning's where it all starts, because that's where they decide way down the road how that money's going to be spent. And we've done that again in Georgia. When I went to my first MPO meeting, Metropolitan Planning meeting, the door was locked. I couldn't get in. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, what do I do? And this man walks up and he goes, can I help you? Where are you trying to get to? And I said, I'm here for the MPO meeting. And he goes, well, I don't know what that is, but I'm here to do transportation. And I said, that's what it is. You're where I want to be. Get me in. So you got to make sure they even know what their job is. But those are the key places, two of the key places. If you have a transit, you want to be on the transit board. If you have an MPO or a regional commission, which you do, you want to be on that board. Now, the other thing that happened in Georgia last year, this was real interesting. They were trying to figure out a way to deal with the less gas tax and how were they going to fund transportation, and not just public transit, but all the transportation, because in Georgia, they were broke. I mean, they tell you, they weren't even fixing the holes in the street. And in fact, there's one bridge in Georgia that's still closed to this day because they didn't have the money to fix it. So you have to go the long way around. So they decided to put to vote to the public a 1 cent penny sales tax for 5 years. And that tax was going to go to transportation. And the way they decided to do it was to divide the state up into regions, which it already was. And they decided that the commissioners and several folks would be involved in deciding what projects that money would be, how it would be spent. So the disability community, the state independent living councils, the National Federation of the Blind, the Georgia Council of the Blind, the Easter Seals, and the developmental disability community said, we want to be at the table. We want to be involved in helping to decide on the project list that's going to go before the voters. So we showed up at the meetings just to make sure that they understood that we were going to have a say. So we helped to plan what those projects would be, and one of those was, of course, obviously more funding for public transit, more funding to the paratransit systems. And it was funny because I was attending all my meetings and I missed one meeting, and when I got back, I saw the new list, and all of a sudden, all the public transit stuff was gone. And I was hot. I located my county commissioner who was serving our area, and I said, what happened to the public transit? He said, I don't know, Alice, I missed it too, but trust me, I don't want you chasing me around. I'm going to make sure it gets put back on. So they did. But it went before, what happened was it did go before the public. But unfortunately, everybody voted it down because it was a tax except for two regions. And those two regions were the Columbus, Georgia area, which is southwest Georgia over by Alabama line, and the Augusta area, which is South Carolina line. And they actually passed it. And so starting in January, the money has started to be collected, and they're starting on those lists. The other part of that that we insisted was somebody with a disability needs to be involved in the oversight just to make sure that you stick to what the money's to be spent on and that our projects aren't done. And so that is happening in those two areas. So that's kind of on the local level how you advocate for things. The advisory boards are good, and I'm not saying they don't have their place, but to truly be effective, you need to get involved on the actual boards where they decide how that money's going to be spent. Oh, and Louisiana, I'm sorry, one thing real quick. See me afterwards. I'm going to tell you how in rural Georgia we have a regional system that's covering 13 rural counties.
All right. Excellent. Thank you, Alice. And we'll leave some time here at the end for questions, but I'd like to have Jeff, Tom, come and talk a little bit about the experience that he has had in the country of California. Which, quite literally, is its own land in so many ways, and in particular, you know, you start dealing with transportation boards, coalitions, local, regional, and statewide coalitions. We've asked Jeff to talk a little bit about how the blind community, in particular, you know, CCB and he himself have sort of navigated the waters within the state of California. So with that, I'd like to introduce the first vice president of ACB, Jeff Tom.
Okay, thank you. So this is kind of going to be a little bit of a shotgun approach because I wanted to address sort of a few things that popped up in over the last few minutes and what I heard. It's really important, and I'm not going to go over duplicate any of what Ella said, but it is important if you can to try and develop someone with expertise in your state that can talk. You know, you obviously need people on these advisory boards and on these planning boards because so much of it is local. But it's important to develop someone in your state, if you can, that those people can go to and say, what do I do in my community? What's the appropriate jurisdiction for me to do X, Y, or Z? If something it has to do with maybe a state highway or whatever, you might have multiple jurisdictions involved. Or if it's funded by federal or state funds, it could involve your state transportation agency as well as the local district. And so it's important to have somebody with some expertise, you know, like an Alice, that your state folks can go to say, okay, here's the best way to try and navigate the issue. And that's, I think, what I want to mention on that. The other thing that I wanted to say is, and I've heard this so many times, both from people inside and outside of California, they say, you know, they're cutting back on services. These people don't care. I'm going to just bail out because it's just not worth it. Well, the problem with that kind of a viewpoint is that in the long term it does you no good, because eventually things will turn around and there will be some more money and there will be more efforts. You don't know when. It may not be for a while, or it may already, in many cases, it has already started. But if you're there only during the good times, all these other folks are going to be ahead of you in the line because they're going to have built the network and all the connections. But if you're there in the bad times on all the policy-making bodies and advisory boards, then you know the players. And when it comes to better times, they're going to listen to you far more quickly than they would be if you're only there, you know, trying to get at the public trough when things are going well. So you got to hang in there. The other thing, to give a partial answer to something that Debbie said, to try and defeat all these arguments, if you cozy up to, your transit district folks want the same thing you do. They often can't say it because their bosses, be they on boards of supervisors or whatever, you know, they can't say that, but they want it. But they can tell you what other allies to make. They can tell you who to go to. You know, they'll be happy to talk with you informally about, you know, what might be done to try and turn some heads on this issue and make some friends. So, you know, I don't have a great answer for you, but that's one. Let me tell you very briefly, and I know I'm going kind of quickly, but let me tell you very briefly about what we've done on the state level. And at the same time address a rather innovative funding source that California now has and that you folks in Illinois might be interested in. We have been involved in a couple of coalitions. One was a branch of America Walks called Cow Walks, primarily for pedestrian safety issues. But we first got involved in that, about 15 years ago, I guess, Donna, would you say, and Mitch? Something like that. And we've stayed in that on and off, and it built us relationships. It gave us some networking with a lot of groups that we wouldn't have had. Now, in the last couple of years, during Donna's presidency, we've been involved in a true transit coalition. It's called Transform, and it involves a lot of groups, transit groups, bicycle, pedestrian groups, and it's done a few things for us. Number one, I've learned more than I ever thought I wanted to know about transit funding. Number two, it has given us a chance to be involved in a steering committee with real experts in the field, and that's really important because we're the only disability group that is involved in it. It gave us an opportunity to do some lobbying on issues. And here's another thing that it did, and I'm going to sort of finish with this, I think. Well, one more little thing, too. It also gave us a chance to, in essence, force the group not to lobby on issues that were sort of important to the bike folks that really were rather irritating to us. There was an issue, I want to try and describe this in 2 minutes. There was an issue called cycle tracks. And cycle tracks is the deal where you move the cars out for the parking lane for cars out from the curb a ways, and the bikes go in between. And so you, as a pedestrian, are going to get out right in the middle of the, potentially, in the middle of where traffic could be, where you might get hit by a bike or, you know, getting out on the other side, you might get hit by a car or whatever. So it is starting to become something that more and more communities are looking at because, you know, bicyclists, at least many of them, really like it because it gets them out of where the cars are. Well, for blind people, it isn't so great. So they were going to make this a priority measure to allow more locals to do this. They were going to make this a priority legislative measure to lobby at the state legislative day last year. If it hadn't been for CCB coming in there and saying, hey, you can't do that. This is not a friendly issue to pedestrians, they would have lobbied on it. So, you know, it's really important to be involved in these coalitions at times. And finally, the other thing, and I didn't even think about this until Jennifer had mentioned it, we've also been involved in a lot of Medicaid coalition sorts of activities. And yes, indeed, one of the issues we have been involved in, not a great deal, but briefly in, his transportation. So that came up as well. And I think with that, probably should leave time for questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, we've got time for about two or three questions.
Thank you. This is Donna Seliger. I have a little story to tell you. Kathy Welch lives in Pahrump, Nevada, and it's a town of about 40,000. They had no bus service, no cab service, nothing for public transportation. So she almost single-handedly went to the city board and told them that they needed some public transportation. And then she went out and got signatures from anybody and everybody that she could to prove that they needed some public transportation. Then she organized all the blind people in the area. And now they have taxi service. They have a shuttle that goes once a day into Las Vegas. And they will soon have bus service. So it can be done. I think Kathy should be on the transportation committee.
That's fantastic. Anyone else? Oh, yeah.
This is Marcia Farah. I wanted to ask the previous speaker, and I let her get away. But I wanted to ask just in general, if you all could comment, Jeff, I'm thinking about you since you are an attorney. If we wanted to, for example, in a small community, try to do a forum on transportation needs, and one of the aspects of that would be seeking volunteers. One of the things that always comes up is the liability issues for volunteer drivers and, of course, insurance and so forth. How could we best approach that? Who would we involve? Insurance agencies? Just curious, who?
Marcia, I'm going to tell you to call Jeff Chapman because his idea for my area is strictly a volunteer program. He thinks that's the answer, especially to get the churches back involved. And he's figured all that out, he said, and that's what he's told me, and he's been pushing it at the state level. So I bet he'd be willing to come down there to Rome and talk to you all.
So I was going to mention this really quickly. California is rather California is rather innovative funding source. We passed a bill a few years ago that requires polluting industries, if they're going to keep polluting, to pay money over to the state, and the money has to be used for things that will make the state cleaner, make the air cleaner, and things like that. And so transportation. Public transit is one of the huge areas for which money can be used under this scenario. And so it's a battle between transit and other things as to how much they're going to get. And we've been involved in lobbying for public transit in this area. So this is something that a state such as Illinois, for example, I think you're going to see with all the carbon footprint sorts of things that are coming up in today's environmental discussions. I think other states may eventually adopt some of this, and I wouldn't be surprised if Illinois is one of those states that considers it. So it's called cap and trade. You get the money, and then you spend it for other purposes.
Okay. Yep, I do. We've been playing musical chairs with the microphones up here. Well, it sounds like that's about it. But our speakers are here, and they will remain around through the break if there are questions that folks have, one-off or one-on-one questions that they'd like to have answered. Come up to the front table here, and they're around. So with that, we will take a break until about 3:45, when our next presenters will be here. Okay. Anybody that was looking to buy a candy bar, apparently they are sold out. Anyway. Before we get moving again, I wanted to recognize Sarah Conrad with ACB Students for a drawing. Sarah.
All right, so we'll do one drawing now, and then we'll do a drawing at the end of today's sessions. And in case you didn't get one of those candy bars, right now the raffle prize for now are assorted classic truffles from Godiva. So, you know. All right. Someone's lost. Okay. All right. I'm going to go ahead and draw the winning. And the winner is number 285. Anyone? Is there a winner? I'm guessing there's a winner in the back. All right. I will find you in just a second. Don't forget trivia night tonight. You can still buy tickets for $10. Leslie Spoon has them. Or at the door for $12, 8 o'clock. Thanks.
We are a chocolate-centric conference. All right, guys. Before we have our next presenter, well done, Mr. Campbell. Before we have our next presenter, I wanted to announce and thank publicly our corporate sponsors for the mid-year meetings. Our presidential sponsors, Google, and even though they didn't make it onto the sheet, the cover sheet in time, Microsoft, along with our congressional sponsors, Vanda Pharmaceuticals, Verizon. We greatly appreciate their support in what it is we're doing and have been doing this whole weekend. We have good relationships with these companies. That's not to say that we always agree, and we talk to them about accessibility challenges all the time. But the good thing is that we've got very collegial relationships with these companies, and they happen to think very highly of us as an organization. And through their financial support, it makes things so much easier on the organization to put events on like this one today. So thank you to them. So this afternoon, you all, a couple of years ago, were privy to a presentation that was done at sort of a 35,000-foot level on some of the basic data that was collected from the survey that Google and ACB worked on together. As you'll recall, in August of 2011, we teamed up with Google to put together a survey that dealt a lot with technology, but it just dealt with a lot, period, because Google is like the king of data-driven corporations. Most corporations are, but tech companies in particular are absolutely gaga for data. And we had been talking with them about our community and what they really wanted to know, because we started off with some fairly interesting conversations surrounding the inaccessibility and complete inaccessibility of some of their products. They agreed to take a look at the inaccessibility of some of these products, but through the development of the relationship, it became apparent that they really didn't understand our community. it also was very apparent that there wasn't a lot of reliable current data on our community in the areas that they were wondering about. Stuff like technology, for instance. So we embarked on this journey to set up a survey, and I know that many of you in this room completed the survey. God bless you. It took about a half hour to complete. It was very long. And it asked a lot of questions to get a sense of demographics and education levels and employment and the use of technology, commercial assistive technology, all sorts of things to get a better handle on our community, what our community looked like then. I would argue that overall our community looks very much the same roughly 3 years later. Analyzing the data after the survey was done became a big challenge. And what we struggled with was, okay, how are we going to do this? Obviously, Eric Bridges, or others within our office don't have the time to do it, the time to devote to do it well. And we began to sort of scan the landscape to see who within our community we could approach to take a look at this, and who in our community could we approach that would have an interest in this data, not just analyzing it for ACB, but rather their own, you know, they would have some vested interest in looking at the data as well. And we found a partner in National Industries for the Blind. Many of you are aware of National Industries for the Blind. We'll call them NIB from here on. They operate as a government contractor, and through a network of organizations across the country employ between 5,000 and 6,000 individuals who are blind or visually impaired. And so some of this data was going to be interesting to them. And so through the relationships that ACB has with NIB, we approached them, and they agreed to look at the data and to sort of pick out areas that seemed interesting or areas that were relevant to them, stuff that may not have been known or things that were hypothesized about within our community, but we didn't have the data necessarily to back it up. So they're here today, and Matt Wiesler, who's the Director of Strategic Intelligence for NIB, will be talking with you about some of the findings, but also he's going to provide a general update on what NIB is up to. You all are aware of a resolution that was adopted last year at our convention that dealt with the very negative impact that the sequester had on employment for individuals who are blind or visually impaired working in NIB-affiliated organizations. And we have been in pretty regular discussions with NIB about that, offering our assistance. So Matt's going to talk a little bit about NIB, about some of the survey data, and generally provide some input and ouch, my dog keeps moving and poking me in the foot for the last 30 seconds. I'm sorry. It's very unprofessional. He's here to talk about all that. And before he gets started, I did want to also welcome my counterpart at NIB, Tony Stevens, who's here. He's a great colleague. And Tiffany Jolliffe. So with that, I'd like to welcome the Director of Strategic Intelligence at NIB, Matt Wiesler. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks, Eric. Okay, so part of my presentation, part of the time I was going to spend was introducing Tony and Tiffany. Is this a little better? All right, I adjusted the mic. Is that a little better now? Okay, sorry about that. So what I was saying is thank you, Eric, for the introduction. Thank you for introducing Tony and Tiffany, who I work with on an ongoing basis at NIB. Tiffany is actually responsible for a lot of the analysis that was done on the Google ACB data. So hats off to her and all the analysis that she pulled together. I would say Tony's probably responsible for me being here, so depending on how this goes, hats off maybe to Tony, maybe not. We'll see. Just to walk through the agenda of what I'm going to talk about, as Eric mentioned, I want to talk a little bit about the background on the survey. I know that you were briefed on this a couple of years ago, so it might be a little bit of a refresher, and I'll try to breeze through that a little bit. Talk a little bit about some of the caveats to the data, some of the findings, demographic findings, employment findings, which are of very much of an interest to NIB. And I will say that while you may have been looking, Eric, for a partner, as soon as I heard about the data, I was kind of waving my hand and saying, somebody talk to Eric, somebody talk to ACB, because I'd love to see the data. So we thank you very much for reaching out to us and for allowing us to use this data as well. Technology usage is of key interest for NIB, even though the survey data is 3 years old. There are a lot of usage trends that we can pull out from NIB's perspective. And as Eric mentioned, talk about NIB. Talk a little bit about some focus group research that Tiffany did last year at your conference in July, as well as at the NFB conference. And to provide a general update on NIB, you know the challenges that we had last year, just an update on where we ended the year, some of the challenges that we have going forward, as well as some of the opportunities that we're seeing. So I don't want to bore you too much with data and statistics, but I will bore you a little bit with data and statistics. Again, my name is Matt Wiesler. I'm Director of Strategic Intelligence for NIB. I've been there for about 5 years. I've been in my current role for about 3 years. No one really knows what strategic intelligence is at NIB. I don't know. I tell people I work in the D.C. area for a three-letter organization in the intelligence field and kind of leave it at that and just see how that works. That's typically the reaction I get. There definitely is an interest from NIB's standpoint. The Strategic Intelligence Department at NIB has two functional roles. One is market research. And so that's a big hat that Tiffany wears as research coordinator for NIB. And pulling together data like this it really feeds into the other part of what we do, and that is strategic planning. So not looking 6 months or a year down the road, but trying to look 5 years, 10 years down the road. What is NIB going to look like? What are the employment opportunities going to look like? What do people who are blind want to do in terms of employment, in terms of careers? What kinds of educational goals do today's youth have to help us figure out 10 years from now what types of jobs and careers do we need to focus on? I won't get into too much on the background of the survey. Obviously, you know, it was a partnership with ACB and Google. It was conducted in August of 2011. There were 722 completes out of 952 total survey takers who were from the U.S. So about three-fourths, I'm a stats guy and I can't even get my stats right, about three-fourths were from the U.S. And according to my notes, about 10% of those were from the country of California, I think, Eric, is how you described it, which was the state with the highest representation. The survey had a global reach, obviously. If a quarter of the respondents were from outside the U.S., it was conducted using ACB's email, Twitter, Google blogged about it. NIB even sent out announcements through our weekly newsletter to encourage participation. There were 89 questions on the survey. I take my hat off to any and all of you who completed an 89-question survey. I deal with surveys all the time, and I try to keep mine under 10. Some of the caveats that I noticed in the survey, first of all, it was an online survey, so it was really focused on people who are already technology users. There's a percentage of people who do not use computers, who are not online, who would not be taking the survey unless they found out about it through some kind of offline means. And so it's not necessarily a representative sample of the entire U.S. population of people who are blind. It's also unclear how many people actually received the invite. I know that Tiffany took the survey, but she found out about it indirectly. I think it was through a Twitter link that was forwarded to her. And the third thing, and this focuses really more on the technology side, is that even in just 2.5 years, there have been a lot of technological improvements, and accessibility has even improved in some ways since the survey was completed. The survey asked demographic questions, vision-related questions, education-related questions, technology, and employment-related questions. Just a few stats. Again, I'm not going to try to bore you with that, but I feel I have to fulfill that role. The average age of the respondent was 46. 44%, happy birthday, 44% of the respondents were female, 56% were male. The majority of respondents were totally blind. 60% of respondents were totally blind. Good, I found something that somebody was interested in. The average year of vision loss onset was 1975. So I think that's an indicator of given the age that the average age of 46, people were relatively young when they started losing their vision. 50% of people who responded to the survey were employed. That was a very interesting figure from NIB's standpoint. 50% were employed. Yep, so they had a job. And hopefully still have a job. We did break down, and I say we, Tiffany broke down the data to look a little bit more at the different levels of vision and the educational attainment and employment levels. For people who were totally blind, 57% were employed. People who were legally blind indicated 47% were employed. And there were also questions, if you recall, about other disabilities in addition to blindness or visual impairment. And 48% of individuals who indicated they had disabilities in addition to vision loss were employed. Again, given the numbers that I think we typically speak about overall in terms of employment for people who are blind, these are actually pretty good. Again, this is not a representative sample, though, of the entire population of people who are blind. In terms of education, 66% of people who are totally blind had a bachelor's degree or higher. 58% of those who said they were legally blind had a bachelor's degree or higher, and 53% of those with multiple disabilities said that they had a bachelor's degree or higher. Those are all very interesting trends, very interesting data points from NIB's perspective, because as those of you who are familiar with NIB know, we were founded from more of a manufacturing standpoint where education was not necessary to possibly get some of the types of jobs. But as we expand into more services types of jobs where college degrees are not just recommended but required, there's a huge population that that we could potentially serve or maybe pull away from their current jobs with much better jobs. Roughly 20% of those who responded currently work in the public sector. And Tiffany looked at some of the general numbers that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau publish and found that about 15% of the total U.S. population works in the public sector. So a little bit more heavily weighted towards the public sector. Nonprofits employed about 18% of respondents, versus about 10% of the general population. So between the public sector and nonprofits, people who are blind or visually impaired are more heavily represented versus the overall U.S. population. 20% of survey respondents were self-employed. Unfortunately, I don't have the comparable number, but I thought that was an interesting number for people who are out identifying their own jobs. There were several questions, several different options that people could select in terms of the types of jobs in which they were currently engaged. Running the numbers, about 27% were in the technology field. And again, I say were only because the survey data is a couple years old. That doesn't mean that they're not currently there now. One person was a professional athlete. I don't know who that was. 16% actually indicated they were in education, specifically they were teachers. And 17 years is the current average in terms of tenure of people in their field. Looking at some of the technology usage, in terms of computer ownership, around 99% of respondents owned their own computer. So again, very heavily weighted the survey was towards people who are technology users. And that makes sense because it was distributed online. 80% of those who were computer users, who had their own computer, purchased it themselves. 27%, and I realize it totals to more than 100, but people had more than one computer in many cases. So there is, I can do math sometimes. 27% Voc Rehab purchased their computer. 402 of the respondents, so over half, actually had multiple computers. Of those who had multiple computers, 305 were employed. So that was a little bit, right around 50%, just under 50%, which ties into the overall employment number, makes sense. 47% owned a smartphone. And comparing that to the U.S. population, again, this is 2 years ago, 35% of the total U.S. population 2 years ago owned a smartphone. So the population of respondents who used a smartphone was actually higher 2 years ago than the total U.S. population. In terms of assistive technology preferences, again, this is something that NIB is interested in terms of how we develop new types and make jobs more accessible, is trying to figure out what types of assistive technology people are using. Screen readers were the most used technology. 73% of respondents used JAWS. 33% use Window Eyes, 30% use System Access. Again, people do use multiple assistive technology. So again, the math will total to more than 100. I didn't forget my math for that one either. Braille displays were used by about 36% of respondents. Open Book was used by 40%. The Kurzweil 1000 was used by 37%. And 24% use Zoom Text as the most popular magnifier. This was a Google survey, so I'm sure Google was very interested in the types of applications that were used. They were probably very happy to see that 45% of respondents used Gmail. It was far and away the highest email usage platform. And this is, again, 2 years ago, but 67% of respondents used social media 2 years ago. It's the way that technology has taken off, and the usage of smartphones and the usage of more of an app-based system on smartphones and the usage of social media is changing how NIB is viewing employment, specifically from recruiting, how we're communicating about jobs, how our agencies are starting to look at communication for recruiting, for advocacy. And from NIB standpoint, this is all very interesting, very useful, and very applicable data. So I want to thank ACB. I want to thank all of you. I want to thank Eric again for allowing us to start peeling back the onion, so to speak, on all of this data. And we are nowhere near complete. Sorry, Tiffany. In terms of analyzing the data, But as we continue to analyze and find more interesting facts, this is something that we've talked about with Eric. We definitely want to share more of that information with the ACB membership. So I wanted to talk a little bit, kind of tying the research standpoint together, in about focus groups that Tiffany conducted last year. In July of last year, she attended both the ACB and NFB conferences. She conducted a number of focus groups and individual interviews. Excuse me, my allergies were acting up a little bit. And she spoke with 33 students, individuals who were the scholarship winners for ACB or NFB, so very highly motivated, very driven individuals. That's a caveat, by the way. It's not representative of the entire student body population for students who are blind, but it is an indicator of the types of interests, the types of jobs, the types of careers in education that some students are striving for. An example of that is the range of the types of careers that students were pursuing, anywhere from musical performance to pediatric oncology. We asked questions about whether the students had career goals. 93% said that they did have career goals, both short-term and long-term. What kind of obstacles they thought they would face. And by and large, the two things that popped out, one was external. They thought that discrimination would be a potential obstacle that they would face. And the other was internal. It was they were worried that they might have a lack of confidence as they were pursuing their career. And there were three respondents or three participants from the country of California. Sorry to keep running with that running joke. That's right, six states soon. The six states of California. Just repeating the news, not promoting one way or the other. Almost all, we did ask questions about, ask them, the students, to think back when they were in high school and what their plans were. And almost all of them, 97%, said that even when they were in high school, that they had planned to attend some type of post-secondary school, feeling that it was really a natural step for them. In terms of their current status as college students, 57% were planning to or were already attending graduate school. And this compares to about 34% of the entire U.S. student body population. We looked at a survey that was done of Gen Y students for comparison and found out that these, again, highly motivated students were much more motivated to continue their education beyond their undergraduate degree. We asked about challenges that they were facing in their current environment as college students, and the biggest obstacle that they mentioned was accessibility of PDF documents, not even accessibility as a whole, but specifically PDFs and getting scanned documents versus accessible PDFs. One of the other obstacles that some of them mentioned was a lack of willingness on the part of their professors to make accommodations. Some of them were able to work with their with the disability support office on their campus. In other cases, we even had an example where one student completely changed their major because they just were not able to get their professor or professors to help them with accessibility. I mentioned before that one of the challenges that students thought they would face in their careers, and it actually applied when they were in college as well. They may have been much stronger advocates for themselves in high school than they were in college, and once they reached college, they may have lost some of that confidence. In terms of using the Career Services Office, most students, 72%, did not use the Career Services Office in their college or university. That is relatively consistent with some of the other research that we found. There was a Virginia Tech study where around 60% did use a Career Services Office, but 49%, and I'm not sure how the math added up there, wish that they had learned more about career services as they went through their career, through their college career. So career services is one area where I think students felt like there was an opportunity for them to leverage a resource that was available, but there wasn't a lot of confidence in that resource. I've got 8 pages of a report that I'm not going to read to you word for word, so I'm just skipping through to some of the highlights. I don't want to put any of you to sleep. We did ask about previous employment, and almost all of the students who were part of these focus groups or interviews had worked in some sort of unpaid internship that usually lasted for a summer. About half of them had hoped to have 2 or 3 internships before they graduate. 90% volunteered and volunteered extensively. So that may be why they were scholarship winners for ACB and NFB, because they were pursuing opportunities outside of just their education. When asked about the skills that students felt that they would need to get the jobs that they were pursuing, they cited independence and technology knowledge as the two primary components. When asked about career obstacles, again, there was the perceived stigma about their vision loss as one of the biggest challenges. But they felt that the way that they would get around that is just proving themselves. So again, a sample of students who are definitely go-getters saying that what they're going to do is they're going to go get whatever it is that they want to do. We asked about assistive technology and usage of assistive technology, and students stated that their proficiency level with the various assistive technology products were only about what they needed to know. They didn't necessarily pursue additional technology usage, and that finding was kind of striking for me, because some of the jobs that we are looking to try to expand at NIB have a very high computer and assistive technology usage need. So we are always looking for individuals who have very strong capabilities with assistive technology. And if students are saying, well, we're only going to learn about as much as we need, or we'll learn as we go along, that creates a challenge and an opportunity. Employers typically, at least from my experience and the different jobs that I've had, they want to see someone who can hit the ground running. And this is regardless of whether someone is visually impaired, blind, sighted, college student, or experienced professional. There are some things that the incoming employee will need to know, but there's a certain expectation that employers have of capabilities when someone starts a job. So that's a quick wrap-up of the focus group research. Again, that's something that Tiffany did last year. We've already started talking about opportunities for additional research at the conference this coming year. And actually, it's later this year. Get my dates right. Is Las Vegas, is that right? Tiffany might not be able to go this year because it's in Las Vegas. Because it's in Las Vegas. So someone more responsible, like her boss, me, might need to go instead. I've got 2 little kids at home. She knows that I'm probably going to be the one staying at home with the 2 little kids. Now, Tiffany does a great job, and she has so many connections due to her work with ACB and the ACB students group. So it's very helpful, very beneficial, and I would send Tiffany before I would send myself, even to Vegas. So I do want to shift gears a little bit. So that's a little bit of the research side. And Eric mentioned also providing a brief update on NIB and what's going on at NIB. So if I could start by asking, just to get a sense of the audience, who in here has worked for, currently works for NIB or one of the associated agencies? If you could raise a hand. Okay, we've got a few people. Who in here has never heard of NIB? Okay, there are a few people who've never heard of NIB. Good, that's good to know. So I'm not going to go through the 75 years of history of NIB, but I think Eric summed NIB up pretty well. We are primarily in a government contractor. We work through an association of 91 nonprofit agencies scattered throughout the country. They hire people who are blind to do anything and everything from producing widgets to widgets being pens, office supplies, sewing textiles, providing different types of services, call centers, 508 assurance testing, contract management, and pretty much anything in between. NIB interfaces directly with a very, very, very small federal agency that manages the Federal Ability One program. That's the federal procurement program that is 75 years old and enables the employment of the individuals who work through our agencies. So Eric mentioned the resolution that ACB passed last summer because of the challenges that NIB was facing. And just to walk through kind of what those challenges were, we really saw at NIB a perfect storm in 2013. Sequestration was the big one. When that hit on March 1st, our federal customers basically, it's like turning off a water faucet or water spigot. Orders virtually ceased because our customers had no idea what their budgets were going to be, how much they were going to get cut, what was going to get cut, and whenever there is a cut in budget, the first things that go are always training, travel, and office supplies. And we cover one of those. So our commodities business that covers things like pens, pencils, and other office supplies was really hit hard. At the same time, the federal government had been budgeting by continuing resolution for the last couple of years. Now, they did finally pass a budget for the remainder of this year. And the problem there, again, has to do with our federal customers. And they then have to try to budget their own businesses, essentially, with a lot of uncertainty. And so when they have uncertainty, they're not buying as much from us, from the Ability One program, as they previously did. What's good for the country in terms of bringing troops back from Afghanistan is not necessarily as good for organizations that are providing the uniforms, providing the mess trays, providing other products and services to the military for those troops who are stationed overseas. And so as troops are brought home, there is less demand for things like military uniforms. And there were also changes that were put into place by our second largest customer, which is the General Services Administration, GSA, where they were purposely drawing down the inventory levels that they had. So they're a huge buyer of things like office products. But right about the same time that sequestration hit, they decided that they were going to drop their inventory levels. So when there were some customer orders coming in during sequestration, those orders were being filled out of inventory, but there was no ordering on the back end. So that was just a real perfect storm that hit our agencies. We ended the year with 238 fewer people who are blind employed across our agencies, 402 fewer in the Federal Ability One work. That was somewhat offset by increases by some of our agencies in selling products or providing services either to state governments through state procurement programs or through working with what we deem commercial or private sector buying. So the little bit of a silver lining on that cloud is that some of our agencies are starting to diversify a little bit more and rely a little bit less on the federal government, especially given all the challenges that we've had. And the reason why those employee numbers were down is because the federal dollars were down. In terms of sales, we were $59 million lower, which was about 10% across the board. So some of our agencies fared worse than that. Some of our agencies were able to, especially agencies that were diversified, were actually able to maintain or and shift resources, so shift people from jobs that were declining into jobs that were still growing, and they were also able to bring in new customers. So there were some challenges. We still have some challenges. General Services Administration is a big challenge because they're continuing to evaluate and update how they model their business. And Tony and I were talking about this. I don't want to get into too much detail, but as they start getting more and more out of the procurement business directly and start outsourcing more of that, then we start dealing from the NIB standpoint with organizations that don't hold as much inventory as the federal government, because someone like a Staples or an Office Depot is responsible to shareholders, and so they try to maintain as little inventory as possible. So it's a little bit more of the just-in-time type of inventory management. Now, there are some opportunities that we're seeing in 2014 and that we even saw in 2013. Despite the drops in employment in terms of the number of people, the average wages in our agencies increased to $10.43 an hour. On the what we, and we split that between products and services. The products is more the manufacturing side. The products wages were $9.35 an hour on average, and services were $13.79 an hour on average. So while we are transitioning towards more and more service opportunities, those are also the opportunities where the income opportunities are higher. 401 individuals were placed by NIB agencies into employment outside of the agency, so into different types of community types of employment. I've been talking a lot about the services business because that really is the bright spot for NIB going forward. And I'm not even saying that for this current year or next year. This is something that it's a long-term trend that we've seen in the U.S. There is some manufacturing that is coming back from overseas, but by and large, services is where the growth is for the U.S. economy as a whole. And it's the place where we're starting, as assistive technology improves, where we're starting to see more and more opportunities. Services business is now 24% of the employees who are blind in our agencies, which is the highest since we started breaking out products and services over 10 years ago. And I don't have the exact number of employees, but the number of services employees who are blind went up. So of the 238 fewer people we had, the vast majority of those individuals were working in manufacturing because the services side actually saw an increase last year. I mentioned a little bit about the contract management support services. That's something that's very near and dear to my heart. When I first joined NIB 5 years ago, it was to look at this idea that someone had about helping the federal government in its contract management, the challenges that it faced. To date, 154 positions have been created. 21 individuals have been hired out of the training program, either by NIB, and we get first dibs, so we're pretty quick on finding qualified individuals, even if we have to put them in public policy, right, Tony? Tony actually went through the contract management training program, and we plucked him out before he could even get into the contract management sphere and get him into our public policy group. We've had some placements with various federal contractors, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, for example, as well as several federal agencies. The Department of Defense has actually plucked several people out of the training program directly and also hired some individuals from our agencies. So they get some experience working for our agencies and then get hired on full-time with our federal customers. The Business Leaders Program that NIB has been running for a little bit more than 10 years is planning to launch another business management training class later this year. And the way that I describe business management training, it's kind of a cross between a mini MBA program and a corporate management training program where folks get a chance to learn from university professors. And I don't know that they've finalized which university, so I know they were talking to one or two in the D.C. area, so I'm not going to say who it is because I'd probably be wrong, 50-50 chance. Maybe I should go to Vegas. Maybe not. So we're excited about that. It's been a couple of years since we've had a business management training program, and our learning and development group has been reaching out to agencies to start planting the seed and getting agencies ready to think a little bit more about who they think within their organizations might be interested in something. High risers within the organizations, the different nonprofit agencies. So the idea behind business management training from NIB standpoint is we work with the agencies, we identify folks who can come in, take the training, and within 6 months, a year, in some cases as soon as they return to their agency, find opportunities to move up in advance within their agencies. And we've had a fair amount of success with business management training. I think we're over 80% of individuals who have gone through the training have actually received at least one promotion. In some cases, they've received more than one promotion. So it's definitely a program that we want to keep using and keep promoting to agencies and also to employees as an opportunity for them. So Eric just said, should probably wrap it up. The next thing on my agenda was called wrap up. So, Eric, are you sure you're visually impaired? Looking over my shoulder. I just wanted to say one last thing, and that's NIB is and will continue to expand opportunities for Americans who are blind through new and innovative programs and career paths. I do want to thank all of you very much for your continued advocacy, for expanding opportunities, for your support of NIB as we've gone through some challenging times, and all that you do to support our agencies, and all that you do to make sure that you're keeping us honest too and pushing us to continue to promote opportunities for people who are blind. So I don't know, do we have a few minutes for questions, Eric? So we've got time for one or two questions. See a hand up to my left.
If some of our members are looking for employment, what advice would you give them in terms of seeking assistance from NIB or any other just generic advice that we could pass along? Because as you well know more than most, the high unemployment of among people who are blind and visually impaired.
A couple of pieces of, advice or suggestions from NIB standpoint and one that will come from Matt's standpoint. So from NIB standpoint, if folks are interested in employment, certainly reach out to your local agency directly. Reach out to NIB directly. Go to nib.org. We post opportunities that are available. Our HR team takes any direct requests. We have a partnership with American Foundation for the Blind and Career Connect to try to link up people who are blind with job opportunities. We do have some challenges. I'm not going to dwell on them within some of our agencies. So some of our agencies might not be able to identify opportunities for individuals right now. Some of our agencies might not have the right match in terms of the types of products or services that they provide and what the individual is looking for. Find a way to get in sort of in the system, so to speak. Definitely reach out to NIB. And sort of the advice that that Matt would give, and this is based on Matt's own experience. This is not NIB speaking. Be willing to relocate. I'm from South Dakota originally. I know that there aren't very many transportation opportunities for people who are blind in South Dakota. There aren't that many opportunities for people who are blind or sighted in South Dakota with, exceptions of agriculture or maybe some of the larger towns. And for what I was looking for, South Dakota wasn't necessarily the place for me. So I've moved around a little bit. I've been in the D.C. area for about 10 years, but I've been in Arizona. I've been in California, North Carolina, New York. So I've jumped around a little bit looking for opportunities. Again, I've got two little kids now, so I don't see that changing anytime soon, but you know, be open, be willing to expand beyond maybe what you went to school for. Just because someone may have suggested as you were entering college you should get a certain type of degree because that's what everyone who is blind goes for, don't take that as the gospel. You know, figure out what it is you want to do, figure out where the employment opportunities are, both in terms of the types of jobs as well as the locations of jobs. So that's Matt's soapbox, but that's what I can recommend. Can I take one more question, Eric? One more? Well, you're letting me off easy, so I want to thank you all very much for your time. Hopefully you found it interesting. Again, thank you again for the data. We'll be sharing more with Eric so he can share more with you guys, and we continue to partner and move forward with employing for people who are blind. Thanks, Eric.
Hey, would you mind just hanging around a little bit for around 5 o'clock?
No, not at all.
Is that cool? All right, awesome.
Well, we really appreciate that presentation. That was about as comprehensive and substantive presentation as I've heard from NIB in quite some time. Thank you. No, and I didn't mean it that way. You guys are a bunch of rabble rousers. Over there giggling, getting me in trouble. Yeah, as a BMT graduate, as is my wife. You know, I spent the first nearly 6 years of my career working at NIB. So I've seen lots of fits and starts and changes and whatever else you want to call it through the years, be it internally within NIB, within the agencies, but also the procurement habits of the federal customer and how they ebb and flow and have at times a really fascinating and unfortunate impact on the lives of folks that we know and love that are employed at NIB agencies. So the last presentation of the day. Oh, one quick note. Matt and Tony and I think Tiffany will be here at the end if you want to come up and say hi, have any questions that you were too shy to ask Matt, although he was pretty thorough. They're here for just a little bit after we're finished. The last presentation of the day is one that people always find interesting and folks oftentimes get all charged up about what's happening or what isn't happening. And it deals with not necessarily our legislative advocacy, but more the legal component of the advocacy work that ACB does. Stuff like, oh, I don't know, accessible currency. Aren't we ever going to get it, right? You wouldn't believe how many times I've heard that. Stuff like Social Security and the lawsuit that we won 4 or 5 years ago pertaining to beneficiaries being gaining access to their information in alternative formats, and other subjects as well. So we've got like 3 guide dogs within a 2-square-foot area here. But there's a lot that's gone on. There's a lot more that will be taking place in the future, and here to talk about all of that is my boss, ACB's Executive Director, Melanie Brunson. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I thought maybe we were going to have to play a guess who the speaker is. I'm changing my name to Melvin. Anyway, I do have a few things to talk with you about. The first, I heard somebody off to my right saying Melanie, and I think I know who it was. So I was just wanting to see if I could hear the tail end of the statement. find out if I was being invited out to dinner or what was going on over there. Anyway, let's move on. I think I just got created more trouble than anything else. The first item on my agenda, though, is a little bit of legislative material that I would like to speak to before I move into the non-legislative issues. And that is a little piece of legislation that you may be asked about on Tuesday, but that this is where we're going to cover it, and you'll find out why. Some of you have heard of it over the last year or so. It is called, in Washington, D.C. speak, WIA, otherwise known as the Workforce Investment Act, which was supposed to have been reauthorized. It was last authorized in 1998. And it's supposed to be authorized every 5 years. Well, you guys can do enough math to figure out that they're not on schedule. So I guess my question to you is, so what's one more year, right? Congress keeps saying that every year. They get all excited. Last year, the House passed a bill. It went all the way through the House. It's called the Skills Act. Then the Senate got all excited, and the HELP Committee, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, passed another bill that was very different. And then they didn't get theirs to the floor.
If they had, we'd be talking about it on Tuesday. But they haven't. They've got a bill. It's S-1356. And we
have opposed it. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it has the potential to make a mess. I mean, we all know that the current vocational rehabilitation system has lots and lots of problems. And this was, I believe, an honest effort to try to solve some of them. But the problem is that in so doing, as in so many other instances, folks with the less powerful disability groups don't necessarily come out very well when you start changing organizations and start moving programs around. What this bill essentially does is it breaks up the current functions of the Rehabilitation Services Administration, which is the place that currently administers the Voc Rehab program, moves the vocational rehabilitation system to the Department of Labor, moves the independent living program to a new agency called the Independent Living Administration within the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, nobody really knows what it does to things like the Randolph Shepherd program, because they weren't even spoken to in the bill. So one guesses that they might stay at RSA, an RSA in the Department of Education, or they might go to the Department of Labor. The other bigger issue, though, is what happens to the Older Blind program, because it's not Voc Rehab, but it's also not a traditional independent living program, because the independent living programs that they wanted to move to this new independent living administration are only the cross-disability ones. So what we went to the senator's office and said, you know what, this is a problem. Because the other thing is, we all know that, especially in states with separate agencies, the elder blind folks work pretty closely with the Voc Rehab folks. So They said, well, we didn't mean to include the Older Blind Program. They can stay at RSA. So we'll amend it to fix that. But then we find out, but they still have to report to this new agency and tell them what they're doing. So they get to report to both the Department of Education and the new HHS Independent Living Program. So we've created a whole other bureaucracy. There are a number of issues. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but we, if it comes up on Tuesday, the answer is there are a lot of serious concerns about both the cost of this move and the potential that for any problem that it does resolve, it's going to create 2, 3, 4, or 5 more. So we as an organization have, at a minimum, very serious concerns about this bill, and we have actually written letters to Congress, signed on to a couple in opposition to it. The National Council on Independent Living is actively promoting its passage, but that is primarily because they were the prime movers behind the concept of creating the Independent Living Administration, and they really do want that. But I think they're really the only ones talking about it at this point, because Harkin's office isn't working on it anymore actively, and it isn't gaining any new sponsors as far as we can tell. So we do not believe it's going to go anywhere before the November elections, which means it will die. So I'll be here to answer any other questions about that if you think of any over the weekend. But I want to move on to talk about some other things. And yes, Treasury, accessible currency. It will happen. It will happen. Okay? It will happen. And yes, Mitch, it could even be in your lifetime. The Department of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing is saying that at the latest, it should be by 2020. What they are slated to, within the first quarter of this year, settle on the actual technology that they're going to use to produce the tactile feature on the bill. They will then start to make all of the arrangements for the creation of it. And it is part of the issue for taking the time is that once they've decided that, they got to get all their wheels in motion. They need to have enough lead time so that once they do that, they can start to actually produce bills a couple of years ahead of time so that when the rollout occurs, they'll have enough stock to put in circulation. So it's got to be done ahead. But there was a meeting last fall that the National Council on Disability sponsored, and they did say that by 2020 should be the latest when they will have the ability to start making some real progress toward putting accessible currency on the market or in circulation, not on the market. The other thing is that in the interim, because that will not mean that everything else will go out of circulation, they are going to start to implement their money reader distribution program. So, and they're going to work through NLS at the beginning to make them available to NLS, the scanners available to NLS patrons, and then expand it after they get it going. And they haven't figured out all of the, at least at that time, they hadn't figured out all of the logistics for that expansion, but they did recognize that they can't just say, well, if you can, you know, if you're an NLS patron, you can have one, but nobody else can, because there are a lot of people who, for a lot of reasons, are not NLS patrons. So the bottom line is, it is incredibly slow, but they know that if we don't hear from them every so often, we bother them because we ask for updates. And so they are in communication with us, and we are watching very closely now to make sure that there are no other blips that we can't account for. When, if there is a blip, we always ask, why is this happening? What does it mean? So just wanted you to know that we are staying on top of it, and that at this point we believe that they are still on track. It is a much slower track than we'd like, but we keep telling them that too, and they know. So it's a possibility. We've reached out to them to see if they will be ready to give you any updates this summer in Las Vegas. So watch your programs. I anticipate they'll be there in some form or another. The other lawsuit that we won was our suit against the Social Security Administration for failing to provide communications with visually impaired Social Security beneficiaries in a form that they could access. That case, as you know, was successfully won, and they didn't even appeal. So they did, though, really do quite a bit of work to go beyond the court order, and they now provide additional formats than those, in addition to those that the court ordered. There are, however, some ongoing issues, because there are forms that people can fill out online that don't work with screen readers, that we are still working on them to fix that problem. And so we, you've seen some articles in the Braille Forum, if you read that. If you haven't, look for them, because comments to Social Security, as we have seen from their response to our lawsuit, do make a difference. And we are watching that as well, and we will stay on top of that issue. The other thing that I will say about Social Security is that we are asked fairly frequently, well, what about Medicare? And so we have our radar up on that issue as well. And it's an issue that we have periodically put some feelers out to various legal entities to see if we can generate a similar interest. We've also had a couple, and I am looking into the possibility of having some additional discussions with Medicare itself, which would be really nice, because then we wouldn't have to sue them. And, you know, settling things without litigation is always good when we can do that. So that's another area where we will continue to report to you, either at conferences such as this or through the list, the email lists and the Braille Forum. Want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about the Marrakesh Treaty. For those of you who were at convention in July, you know that I had been in Marrakesh, Morocco in June to witness the creation of a text for an international convention on copyright law, and it's got a really long title that involves copyright laws that improve the accessibility of books for people who are blind, have visual impairments, or have other print reading disabilities. We were very active in the World Blind Union delegation that lobbied the World Intellectual Property Organization for the last 8 or 9 years. Actually, I think that WBU internationally had been going over there for about 10 or 15 years now. And the text came into fruition last June. It was very exciting. Everybody called it the miracle of Marrakesh, because just before I left to come, I got an email from the head of the U.S. delegation that said, it's going to die. We're not going to be able to do it. And I got to tell you, when you got to get on a 14-hour flight, that's not a good thing to see just before you go to do that, because you're thinking, well, why am I going then? But I'm sure glad I didn't believe him, because they did it. And it's a good treaty for us. It's got what we wanted in it. We gave up really very little. And it has a lot of potential for making it possible for producers of books to share them with blind people in around the world, so that we don't have to produce 6 copies in English of one book. We can produce 6 different books and share them with Canada and England and Australia and South Africa and New Zealand instead. So that's a good thing. We have a problem, because we have the same problem that any treaty has. Our government did sign the treaty in Geneva in October. Interestingly enough, it got no press because they signed it on like October 3rd while the government was shut down. So all the diplomats were over there working, but the press people were furloughed. And after they got back, they didn't figure it was too late to do a press release, so they never said anything. But anyway, it was signed. And now, guess what the next step is? Senate, yeah, you got it. Senate ratification. So we've kind of been waiting to see what happened with CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, which will be talked about in another point in the weekend. So after that whole issue is settled for a while, we can bring this one up. But we didn't want to confuse things by talking about both of them at the same time. We're hoping this one will be easier, is all I will say at this point. So we'll see. But stay tuned for more on that. The last issue that I've been asked to cover is to give you an update on our structured negotiations. For those of you who know Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian and the wonderful work they do around the country, you know that they've covered a wide range of areas, including bank websites, and they were the prime movers behind getting accessible ATMs. Then they moved into websites. Then they moved into kiosks at grocery store counters. We are all of that work. Some of those things are still being monitored. At this point, I can tell you that there are a lot of really good things coming up very soon. At this point, we don't have anything to specifically report, but I can assure you that within the next couple of weeks to a couple of months, some of you are going to see some rather high-profile and high-impact notices, press releases coming out about some real exciting structured negotiations that are just signatures away from being publicized. We've signed the papers. They're en route back to Lainey and Linda. And once they get all the names on the dotted lines, the companies will start to issue press releases. And they're going to have some nationwide impact. So get excited. I'm just going to whet your appetite, and I'm not even going to tell you what the subject matter is, but I know it's going to impact a large number of you. When you hear about it, spread the word and take advantage of it. Use what's being offered to you. Okay? And that is the end of my report on the advocacy update pieces. And Eric is telling me there is time for one question. So who gets the lucky microphone?
We've just been hearing about credit cards with the digital duwas. I don't even remember what the terms are. That are going to replace the black, you know, the black line
yep.
on the back of the card, and we're going to require a password to yep. to verify sales. What does that do to our point of sale stuff?
Our legal eagles are already way into that, immersed into that. I don't have an answer for you yet, but the question's already been asked to them, and they've said, we're on it, we're looking into it, we'll let you know as soon as we learn more about what's going on. So stay tuned. We're going to fill up those 48 pages real quick, Doug. Okay, Sharon. Ladies and gentlemen, I need to shift gears for a second and do my event coordinator thing now. And I hate to do this because I'm going to pick on the gang dog users again. Folks, when you go to the relief area, please remember you need to go past the entrance to the garage in order to get to the relief area. It is my understanding that we have some puddles of puppy piddle that didn't quite make it to the relief area. So the entrance to the garage is not part of it. And I guess some doggies couldn't wait. So could you help by trying to make sure your dog gets all the way to the relief area before they stop? I don't know whether it's happening when people stop to talk to other dog users or dogs stop to sniff each other or what, but there are a number of puddles out in the garage entrance area. So thank you for your assistance in that matter. And I will now, after that, sorry, Eric, turn it back to you.
Not real sure how you transition from puddles of puppy piddle. But. Anyway, if folks have questions of Melanie, she's up here of the non-topic related version. Before we leave, Sarah Conrad is here with another drawing for the students.